Training Inc. Mantra. We are Training Inc. This is our house. This is our life. We are in charge. We are engine number one of enterprise value added. Excellence is in our hands to choose or lose. Bottom line. Training Inc. and its peers, former bureaucrat-infested, cost-absorbing, value-destroying departments, become the growth and development and strategic positioning engine of the entire business unit. 12.2.9.3 Case Study, PSF Transformation, Trek Credit Department. Trek, high-end bicycles, CEO John Burke offered this case study of departmental transformation. Cost center, the engine of overall corporate value added within his company. Was, credit department. Is, financial services unit. Was, hammer on dealers until they pay. Is, make dealers successful so they can pay. Was, accounts receivable sold to outside commercial company. Is, Trek is the risk-bearing commercial company. Was, oversee peak accounts receivable of $70 million. Is, oversee peak accounts receivable of $160 million. Was, identify risky dealers. Is, identify dealer opportunities. Was, cost center. Is, profit center. Was, no products. Is, products. Consulting. MasterCard, Visa, stored value of gift card peripherals, etc., etc. 12.2.9.4 Internal PSF Framework, Do or Die. Yes, you can. The question arises, but can we do all this when wrapped within a mid-sized division of a huge company? My answer is yes. My second answer, you have no choice. Fact is, you are already a PSF. Every organizational unit on earth serves customers. Serving another department is as much serving a customer as would be the case if the customer were an outside entity. And every one of your activities is or can be reinvented and repackaged as a value-adding would be wow project. What I'm suggesting then is that you step up your game dramatically and act like the value-adding superstars you know down deep you can be. As to the die part of do or die in the section title, recall from Chapter 6 these words from former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. If you think being a professional makes your job safe, think again. Think again indeed. 12.3. The Social Business Narrative. Social business. Who? Everyone. No halfway. 12.3.1. Social business. The 20/5 rule plus. Entrepreneur and respected customer service campaigner John DeJulius, in his book The Customer Service Revolution, Overthrow Conventional Business, Inspire Employees, and Change the World, earns the lead-off slot in this discussion of our third value-added strategy. What used to be word of mouth is now word of mouse. You are either creating brand ambassadors or brand terrorists. The customer is in complete control of communication. It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. Customers expect information, answers, products, responses, and resolutions sooner than ASAP. The language is strong and merited. DeJulius describes a new world order in which responsiveness takes on an entirely new meaning, in which the word instant is not an exaggeration, in which, when referring to reputation, precarious is a 60, 60, 24, 7, 365 state of affairs. That, in turn, suggests for one big thing, a very revved-up definition of employee engagement. Recall the statement by ex-Burger King CEO Barry Gibbons in Chapter 2. He said he would only succeed if every one of his 250,000 employees was in the brand. 12.3.2. Social business. The seven characteristics of the social employee. Effectively operationalizing Mr. Gibbons's one and all in the brand, Cheryl and Mark Burgess in The Social Employee insist that every employee, now a social employee, should, must, necessarily take on a new, fully engaged role. From their book, The Seven Characteristics of the Social Employee. 1. Engaged. 2. Expects integration of the personal and professional. 3. Buys into the brand's story. 4. Born collaborator. 5. Listens. 6. Customer-centric. 7. Empowered change agent. That is a very tall order, but it is not clear that you or I, in a firm or unit of any size, including one-woman band, has a choice in a world where it's no stretch to claim that a hard-earned reputation can indeed be destroyed in a matter of minutes. The most important of the seven characteristics, as I see it, is the last one. Employees, including the newest kids on the block, must have the leeway to respond to untoward events without waiting for the approval of their overlords. 12.3.3. Social business. A single tweet tops a Super Bowl ad. Peter Aceto is the former CEO of Tangerine, a very successful Canadian company that aims to change the world of finance through social media. The startling quote below from Mr. Aceto appears in A World Gone Social, How Companies Must Adapt to Survive, by Ted Coyne and Mark Babbitt. I would rather engage in a Twitter conversation with a single customer than see our company attempt to attract the attention of millions in a coveted Super Bowl commercial. Why? Because having people discuss your brand directly with you, actually connecting one-to-one, is far more valuable, not to mention far cheaper. Consumers want to discuss what they like, the companies they support, and the organizations and leaders they represent. They want a community. They want to be heard. Between using this quote in speech after speech and writing this book, I guess I've read Aceto's words more than 50 times, and every time I read them, I am startled anew. Yet I believe, especially after reading Aceto's own book, We-ology, How Everybody Wins When We Comes Before Me, his remark accurately reflects today's emergent reality. Even if you can imagine your way into the CEO role, but cannot imagine making a statement like this, do consider it a marker of the times. It cannot and should not and must not be labeled extremist. One more obvious takeaway. The CEO tweets. And you? More on the topic in our leadership chapter. And you refers to the chief of a one-person business as much as to the CEO of a big firm. 12.3.4. Social business. Customers take the lead. In Social Business by Design, Transformative Social Media Strategies for the Connected Company, Dion Hinchcliffe and Peter Kim write, customer engagement is moving from relatively isolated market transactions to deeply connected and sustained social relationships. This basic change in how we do business will make an impact on just about everything we do. Deep customer engagement. One more time. Forget 24/7. Substitute 60-60, 24/7, 365. Remember, 5 minutes to destroy 20 years of backbreaking effort. 12.3.5.1. Social business. Return on influence. From Mark Schaefer's Return on Influence, The Revolutionary Power of Clout, Social Scoring, and Influence Marketing. When Virgin America opened its Toronto route and asked Clout to find a small group of influencers to receive a free flight in hopes that they'd effectively spread the word. After the initial 120 participants and an additional 144 engaged influencers had been accrued, the word-of-mouth power kicked in as those highly social individuals generated more than 4,600 tweets about the new route. That led to more than 7.4 million impressions and coverage in top blogs and news outlets such as the LA Times and CNN. Social scoring is creating new classes of haves and have-nots, social media elites and losers, frenzied attempts to crash the upper class, and deepening resentments. Social scoring is also the centerpiece of an extraordinary marketing movement. For the first time, companies can, with growing confidence, identify, quantify, and nurture valuable word-of-mouth influencers who can uniquely drive demand for their products. I think this analysis speaks for itself and speaks a thousand words. However, as is so often the case, it suggests much more than ginning up a social media initiative. It describes a way of life, that old bugbear culture, infused with an all-hands, recall the social employee, obsession with social connection. 12.3.5.2 Social Business. We all need an Amy Howell. Epidemic ignition is her shtick. Again, from the Return on Influence. Amy Howell, social marketer extraordinaire, founder of Howell Marketing, ignites epidemics. In a good way, of course. Epidemics of excitement. Epidemics of business connection. Epidemics of influence. My stepson is following a career in social media marketing. It began with a several-year stint at a sizable Manhattan agency, the 88, where his clients included the likes of Coca-Cola. The lure of the mountains has led him to Denver. His gigs there to date, including full-time stints as director of social media, have included several small firms, restaurants, and the like. The point being that the intensive exploitation of social media is not the exclusive provenance of large firms. Epidemic ignition, a la Amy Howell above, is everybody's business in 2018. 12.3.6 Social Business, Location and Size Independent. Today, despite the fact that we're just a little swimming pool company in Virginia, we have the most trafficked swimming pool website in the world. 5 years ago, if you'd asked me and my business partners what we do, the answer would have been simple. We build in-ground fiberglass swimming pools. Now we say we are the best teachers in the world on the subject of fiberglass swimming pools, and we also happen to build them. Marcus Sheridan, founder, River Pools and Spas, Warsaw, Virginia, quoted in J. Baer, Utility, Why Smart Marketing is About Help, Not Hype. The protagonist, River Pools and Spas, is a smallish, $5 million in revenue, company in a non-exotic industry in an out-of-the-way corner of the world. Did what? They became, in effect, the number one world power player in their industry. Bottom line, Warsaw, Virginia, swimming pools, $5 million in revenue, best in world, social media superpower. 12.3.7 Social Business, ZMOT. 84% of the time, the purchasing decision is made before the traditional marketing process even comes into play. Welcome to the era of ZMOT, the zero moment of truth. Over time, the idea that we need this or that, perhaps a more powerful vacuum cleaner, percolates and becomes more real. And as our senses become attuned to those vacuums, we look at ads in the paper or on TV. Now, on an unfilled Saturday afternoon, maybe it's time for the 10-minute trip to the mall. Let's get serious about this new vacuum. That was yesterday. This is today. The idea of needing a vacuum crosses our mind. We do what we always do these days. We grab our iPad or iPhone or the like and immediately start researching vacuums. Because big data perfectly informs the online process, we are quickly sent to exactly the right place and exposed to teasers that were tailor-made for Tom Peters or Angela Smith based on our last 5 years of shopping activities, including credit card data. Odds are high that in a proverbial flash, we've jumped to the purchase moment. And in another literal flash, Amazon Prime has got the drone warming up. The sale is made before the traditional selling process even starts. Frankly, before the idea has in any way congealed in our minds, and maybe even, increasingly, before we had the idea. One term for the likes of this is ZMOT. Zero moment of truth. Here's Jay Baer's description in Utility. You know what a moment of truth is. It's when a prospective customer decides either to take the next step in the purchase funnel or to exit and seek other options. But what is a zero moment of truth? Many behaviors can serve as a zero moment of truth, but what binds them together is that the purchase is being researched and considered before the prospect even enters the classic sales funnel. In its research, Google found that 84% of shoppers said the new mental model, ZMOT, shapes their decisions. Query. Is your enterprise, of any size, engaged online to the extent that you can fully participate in the great battle of ZMOT? 12.3.8. Social business. Bottom line 1. Everyone. Who should be social media fanatics? Everyone. Who needs a social media director? Everyone. No hype in those assertions. Everyone equals everyone. Case study. Social media and me. Back in 2004, I said, what the hell, better try this, and launched my blog. Great fun, and the blog made it onto several top 500 lists for the entire web. I started tweeting with a vengeance 5 years ago. 50,000 or so tweets later, my rank on an algorithmically determined list of Thought Leaders 2014 Global Top 100 Influencers, published by the Swiss think tank Gottlieb Duttweiler Institute in MIT, was behind the Pope, but ahead of the likes of Elon Musk. That is downright silly, and this note is not intended as braggadocio. It is, however, compelling testimony concerning one soul, me, embracing social media with open arms and being stunned by the result. 12.3.9.1. Social business. Bottom line 2. Social survival manifesto. Social media guru Tom Lykus's social survival manifesto. 1. Hiding is not an option. 2. Face it, you are outnumbered. 3. You no longer control the message. 4. Try acting like a human being. 5. Learn to listen or else. Really listening to others is a must. 6. Admit that you don't have all the answers. 7. Speak plainly and seek to inform. 8. Quit being a monolith. Your employees, speaking online as individuals, are a crucial resource that can be managed through frameworks that encourage participation. 9. Try being less evil. 10. Pay it forward now. Internet culture is largely built on the principle of the gift economy. Give value away to your online communities. Comment. I wouldn't change a word. 12.3.9.2. Social business. Bottom line 3. 11 rules for creating value in the social era. From Nilofer Merchant's book, 11 rules for creating value in the social era. 1. Connections create value. 2. Power in community. 3. Collaboration beats control. 4. Celebrate onlyness, uniqueness of every person. Take advantage thereof. 5. Allow all talent. Forget titles and labels. All are players. 6. Consumers become co-creators. 7. Mistakes can build trust. 8. Learn, unlearn, repeat. 9. Bank on openness. 10. Social purpose unleashes ownership. 11. There are no answers. Comment. Ditto from above. I wouldn't change a word. One of the reasons for presenting the three lists in this section is to emphasize their similarity. Though implementation in general badly lags what's needed, there is substantial agreement about what should be in the guidebook. 12.3.10 Social business, my big five. 5 minutes to lose a reputation that took 20 years to build. 100% of employees in the brand with authority to act independently. Single Twitter exchange, better than a Super Bowl ad. Small town, small company, best in world via social media presence. ZMOT, zero moment of truth. 12.3.11 Far from innocent, social knows all. Welcome to the age of augmented memory, etc., etc. You can run tests on your emails for the last year for keystroke data, how hard you hit the keys, serving as a proxy for anger, stress, and see what times of the day or week you tend to be emotional and how that affects people's responses to your messages. You can cross-reference GPS data with your emails using sentiment analysis, technology that identifies certain words that infer positive, negative, or neutral language patterns to identify the places where you are most productive. John Havens, Hacking Happiness. The social game, it most decidedly ain't a game, has barely begun. These are power tools. Dewy-eyed cheerleading is inappropriate. Wariness is called for. 12.4 The Big Data Narrative. Big data. Mammoth opportunities. Under-examined downsides. 12.4.1 Caesar's Priorities. Caesar's Entertainment has bet their future on harvesting personal data rather than developing the fanciest properties. Adam Tanner, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. This section on big data is short, but I hope reasonably sweet. At some level, all you need to know is included in the quote above. Message 2018, courtesy of Caesars. Forget the real estate, invest in the data. A multi-billion dollar enterprise, best known for its lavish brick-and-mortar gambling palaces, concludes that those collections of bricks and mortar will effectively be supplanted by the very rapid collection and mastication of ones and zeros. That is, supplanted by hyper-fast, hyper-high-volume data processing overseen by unimaginably complex algorithms, which are quickly becoming self-learning algorithms. The thoroughly digested mountains of data will microscopically probe clients' psyches, determine smells and colors that keep those clients pinned to the machines. Machines now account for the bulk of casino profits as long as possible. And all this will drive and ultimately determine the P&L in the future of this giant concern. That is a mouthful. But how exactly does it apply to you and me when we are away from Las Vegas? Our tastes and preferences are becoming ever better known to all with whom we come in contact via our computers and especially our mobile devices, and via our thermostats and our cars and our refrigerators and our physical movements, one step at a time, wherever we happen to be. And the cast of our eyes and the gestures we make at work or play are also microscopically examined by our employers. See my riff on HR software in Chapter 5. Some of this will improve our lives. For example, better medical diagnoses. And some of it will be destructive, being denied some variety of insurance coverage because of some confluence of forgotten events in our distant past. And so, in 2018, We are only about 10 yards down the 100-yard field. 12.4.2. Persado's response rate. Big data. Persado. Persado Persuasion Automation Incorporated. Copywriter versus algorithm. Adapted from the Wall Street Journal. It's finally time to take AI seriously. 1. Copywriter. An industry-experienced human copywriter develops an ad for a cruise line special offer. Up to $250 to spend on all ships to all destinations. 2 days left. The copywriter's ad bags a 1.3% customer response rate. 2. Algorithm. Persado AI is based on big data analysis of the most likely candidates for a cruise experience. The algorithm, per its creators, focuses on emotion words, product characteristics, a call to action, and the position of text and images. Persado's algorithmically determined ad. No kidding. You qualify to experience an incredible vacation with us. Ending with a smiley face emoticon. Persado Persuasion Automation's ad results in a 4.1% response rate. Algo versus human response yield. 4.1% versus 1.3% equals 3x equals dollars, dollars, dollars. A creative person is good but random. We've taken the randomness out by building an AI-driven ontology of language. Lawrence Whittle, Head of Sales, Persado. So goodbye, copywriters. One suspects that the great ones will most likely thrive. But the other 70 to 90%? Question mark. Read, study, cautionary tales. Weapons of Math Destruction. How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy by Kathy O'Neill. Dataclysm. Who We Are When We Think No One's Looking by Christian Rutter. Ethical IT Innovation. A Value-Based System Design Approach by Sarah Speakerman. 12.5. A Brief IoT Narrative. IoT, Internet of Things. IOE, Internet of Everything. A First-Order Game Changer. It's entirely possible that the emerging Internet of Things will be the biggest tech disruption of them all. 12.5.1. IoT comes to hearth and home, creating the conscious home. From Stephen Levy in Wired, where there's smoke. The algorithms created by Nest's machine learning experts and the troves of data generated by those algorithms are just as important as the sleek materials carefully selected by its industrial designers. By tracking its users and subtly influencing their behaviors, Nest Learning Thermostat transcends its pedestrian product category. Nest has similar hopes for what has always been a prosaic device, the smoke alarm. Yes, the Nest product does what every similar device does, goes off when smoke or CO reaches dangerous levels, but it does much more by using sensors to distinguish between smoke and steam, internet connectivity to tell you where the danger is, a calculated tone of voice to convey a personality, and warm lighting to guide you in the darkness. In other words, Nest isn't only about beautifying the thermostat or adding features to the lowly smoke detector. We're about creating the conscious home, Nest CEO Tony Fadell says. Left unsaid is a grander vision with even bigger implications. Many devices sensing the environment, talking to one another, and doing our bidding unprompted. Get it off my chest rant. I do not believe that in any way, shape, or form I qualify as a Luddite. I tweet and I blog like a maniac, and I am an iPhone addict by any measure, even compared to those who are half my age. When I'm on a 2-day business trip, I generally carry 9 electronic devices. Count them. This is not an exaggeration. On the other hand, I will not use Nest products. A thermostat given to me by a high-powered techie friend sits untouched in its box in the corner of my basement. I genuinely believe I merit a perfect 10 on the nothing to hide scale, but I'll be damned if I want my devices from Nest or the refrigerator company or my robotic vacuum cleaner or the smart TV maker chatting about my life with the world at large. I love my unconscious home. Stuff it, Tony. And yes, I know it's a losing battle. 12.5.2. IoT. Sensor pills. Yes, Doc, Tommy didn't take his nighttime Sotalol. Robert Scoble and Shell Israel from Age of Context, Mobile, Sensors, Data, and the Future of Privacy. Proteus Digital Health is one of several pioneers in sensor-based health technology. They make a silicon chip the size of a grain of sand that is embedded into a safely digested pill that is swallowed. When the chip mixes with stomach acids, the processor is powered by the body's electricity and transmits data to a patch worn on the skin. That patch, in turn, transmits data via Bluetooth to a mobile app, which then transmits the data to a central database where a health technician can verify if a patient has taken her or his medications. This is a bigger deal than it may seem. In 2012, it was estimated that people not taking their prescribed medications cost $258 billion in emergency room visits, hospitalization, and doctor visits. An average of 130,000 Americans die each year because they don't follow their prescription regimens closely enough. It's only 2018. The starter's gun has just fired. The everything to everything else derby is underway. For example, the Proteus tool recently received FDA approval. Translation for you and your 25-person HR shop. Do you have an IoT advisor? Do you have a staff techie who is keeping up with the latest move in IoT world? This is not a continuation of my Nest rant above. Saving some fraction of 130,000 lives lost is hardly a small thing. But as always today, there is an on the other hand. On the other hand, what if I lose my health insurance coverage because Proteus data informs my insurer that I am a person who consistently forgets to take his pills? Not idle speculation. Similar data collection is definitely leading to, for instance, cancellation of auto insurance. 12.5.3. IoT. Welcome to Boston, Mr. Immelt. I live near Boston. That's the Boston that in 2016 became the corporate headquarters for America's iconic company, General Electric. Why? GE urgently needs to recruit a multi-regimental army of software superstars and attempt to inject a startup's mindset into a giant bureaucracy. Alas, Fairfield, Connecticut did not fill the technical or psychological bill. Boston, on the other hand, is home to a peerless population of universities such as tech superstar MIT and home to a growing population of business incubators. Some suggest that its tech energy score approaches that of Silicon Valley. The need for all this and the associated urgency, former GE CEO Jeff Immelt effectively bet the company on IoT, making the giant firm's array of industrial products smarter and smarter and connected to all the world is seen as the future. This process is indeed underway. In a Pacific Ocean plane crash in 2016, the best data on the location of the crash came not from navigation systems, but from the aircraft's GE engines. Those engines were, for performance reasons, in constant communication with systems in the GE Aircraft Engine Group's infrastructure. 12.5.4. The many flavors of IoT. IoE. The Internet of Everything. M2M, machine-to-machine, ubiquitous computing, embedded computing, pervasive computing, industrial internet. Here are a few numbers that illustrate the enormity of the IoT world. The primary source is The Big Switch in Capital Insights. More than 50 billion connected devices by 2020, Ericsson. estimated 212 billion connected devices by 2020, IDC. Estimated IoT market size next decade, 14.4 trillion. By 2025, IoT could be applicable to $82 trillion of output, or approximately one half of the global economy, GE. 100 trillion sensors by 2030, Michael Patrick Lynch, The Internet of Us. The IoT, coming at us like an express train, may change more or less everything for everybody over the next 15 years. My usual piece of advice number one for one and all, study as if your professional life depends on it. It does. 12.6. The Women's Market Narrative. Underserved Markets 1. Women as overwhelmingly predominant customer for everything. My education. Heather Shea Schultz called me while I was on the road. She was the CEO of my Palo Alto-based training and consulting company. Heather said she'd organized a meeting to enlighten me on women's issues. Presumably she thought I had a deficit that needed addressing. She pretty much ordered me to attend, and respecting her and her tenacity as I did, I dutifully agreed to show up. I and the group she'd assembled met in Boston. My life was never the same. That is not an exaggeration. At the appointed moment, I walked into the conference room at WordWorks, a superb editorial talent organization run by my longtime colleague, Donna Carpenter LeBaron. About 15 women were having coffee and conversing. Heather introduced me around, and I was, frankly, overwhelmed. One of the women owned a wildly successful home furnishings company. There was an Indy race car driver, the first woman to race at Indy, as I recall, and a senior Disney executive, a college president, and on it went. Heather called us together and said something like the following. Tom has become one of the most prominent people in the business world, and he's a very okay guy. He believes in dramatically increasing the proportion of women in leadership roles and so on, and he appointed me to lead his training company. The appointment, moreover, was made while I was on maternity leave, points for that. As well as a colleague, he is also a friend. Hence, I feel comfortable saying in the de facto privacy of this room that, like most of his species, he's more or less clueless about what it's like to be a woman in business, both in our professional roles and as consumers. And you all have agreed to join me in providing him with a speed learning experience. These were powerful women, and they were unemotional as they recounted tale after tale of misunderstandings or indirect and sometimes direct snubs, from the boardroom to the car dealer's showroom and the doctor's examining room. Thus, in 1996, began my now 22-year-old women's campaign. Let me be clear. I am obsessively devoted to business excellence, and I believe in markets. That is, Tom's women's thing, as some have called it, is professionally animated by bottom-line pragmatism. 1. Women are the premier purchasers of more or less everything. And while most businesses acknowledge that at some level, it is the rare business, still, in 2018, that makes an all-out effort to serve the woman consumer in terms of the works, product design, marketing, delivery, and in fact, overall enterprise strategy. 2. More women in leadership roles equals more money on the bottom line. By a wide margin. Evidence galore. For example, see chapter 15. To state the obvious, or what should be obvious, the two halves of the puzzle interlock perfectly. If you want to take full advantage of women as the predominant purchasers of everything, consumer and commercial, then women must be fully represented at all levels of the organization, especially in senior management and as members of the board of directors. 12.6.1. Women's Market. Globally Dominant. Headline from The Economist. Forget China, India, and the Internet. Economic growth is driven by women. Note, The Economist is not given to hyperbole. From Michael Silverstein and Kate Sayre. The Female Economy. Harvard Business Review. Women now drive the global economy. Globally, they control about $20 trillion in consumer spending, and that figure could climb as high as $28 trillion in the next 5 years. Their $13 trillion in total yearly earnings could reach $18 trillion in the same period. In aggregate, women represent a growth market bigger than China and India combined. More than twice as big, in fact. Given those numbers, it would be foolish to ignore or underestimate the female consumer. And yet many companies do just that, even ones that are confident that they have a winning strategy when it comes to women. To put this staggering data into equation form, W equals greater than 2 times C plus I equals $28 trillion. Women's market size equals more than 2 times China plus India combined equals $28 trillion. Womenomics. One thing is certain. Women's rise to power, which is linked to the increase in wealth per capita, is happening in all domains and at all levels of society. This is just the beginning. The phenomenon will only grow as girls prove to be more successful than boys in the school system. For a number of observers, we have already entered the age of womenomics, the economy as thought out and practiced by a woman. Ode Zissanese de Thun, founder of Women's Forum for the Economy and Society, from the Financial Times. This brief set of quotes hardly tells the whole story of women's market power. They are, however, indicative of the enormity of the phenomenon and hence the enormity of the opportunity represented thereby. 12.6.2 United States, Women as Decision Makers. Women are the majority market. Farrell Warner, The Power of the Purse. From various sources. Home furnishings, 94%. Vacations, 92%. Houses, 91%. Consumer electronics, 51%, 66% of home computing devices. Cars, 68%, significantly influence buying decision in 90% of cases. All consumer purchases, 83%. Bank account, choice of provider, 89%. Household investment decisions, 67%. Small business loans, small business startups, 70%. Healthcare, all aspects of decision-making, 80%. And in the United States, women hold over 50% of managerial positions overall, including over 50% of purchasing officer positions. Hence, women also make the majority of commercial as well as consumer purchasing decisions. Add it up. Women, number one consumer purchases. Women, number one commercial purchases. Equals women buy everything. Hard, cold data. Subtext of this. It ain't even close. The message is not the women's market is too big to be ignored or some such. The message is, to repeat myself, women buy everything. Therefore, do your strategy, culture, and staff composition square with the data above. 12.6.3. Distinct gender proclivities, sales and after-sales processes. A few snapshots as to how this data translates into processes observed in the marketplace. The most significant variable in every sales situation is gender of the buyer, and, more importantly, how the salesperson communicates to the buyer's gender. Jeffrey Tobias Halter, Selling to Men, Selling to Women. I have indeed spent 20-plus years studying the phenomena associated with the data just presented and about to be presented. In my home office, there are two shelves filled to the brim with books, political science, history, economics, marketing, sociology, psychology, that describe and analyze everything from women's social justice movements around the world, dating back to the 1700s, to male-female brain structure differences, to business and marketing processes associated with gender differences. All of which is to say that the statements presented here, necessarily limited by space, are hardly anecdotal, though if there were more space, there is little that I would enjoy more than sharing the stories that I've collected from women, both frustrated and amused, over the last two decades. There are a million male-female jokes, which range from funny to stupid to rude and crude. There are no jokes here. The discussion is, however, about stupidity, businesses continuing stupidity in approaching the largest of all markets. Purchasing process. Male-female differences. The female editor-in-chief of the United Kingdom's Redwood Publications attended a London conference where I spoke. In a conversation about male-female differences after the talk, she observed, "Editorial content. Men prefer tables, rankings. Editorial content. Women prefer narratives that cohere and stir the imagination." By and large, she said, men are attracted to an emotionless marketing pitch. They want hard-nosed comparison of product characteristics. Women, on the other hand, are by and large more interested in stories about the product in use, its benefits and drawbacks. In the paragraph above, I used the term by and large twice. It is implied in every example in this section of the book. There are significant variations in female and male behavior. What is reported here is, if you will, the modal behavior in a bell-shaped curve representation of data. For 15 years, my wife operated a home accessories company, Susan Sargent Designs. One of her product lines was furniture, which she presented, among other places, at the High Point, North Carolina market. She reported, "Male buyers would look at a dining room table and typically comment on something like, what sort of a lathe had been used to turn the table legs? Women buyers would imagine the table in their customer's dining room and talk about that. This is the way it played out, virtually without exception." Well, I stick with my by and large above, but my own repeated High Point observations did square with Susan's. Zero variation. More, and confirmation of the same idea from Jeffrey Tobias Halter, in Selling to Men, Selling to Women. Selling to men, the transactional model. Selling to women, the relational model. And a ditto from women's marketing guru Faith Popcorn in Evolution. Women don't buy brands, they join them. Stanford professor Judy Rosner in America's Competitive Secret, Women Managers, offers this parallel description. Women speak and hear a language of connection and intimacy, and men speak and hear a language of status and independence. Men communicate to obtain information, establish their status, and show independence. Women communicate to create relationships, encourage interactions, and exchange feelings. One last example of the women's proclivity for connection. This from a conversation I had after a speech to a women's group. A Manhattan-based financial advisory services CEO reported that about 5 years before, he had purposefully reoriented his practice toward women's concerns. Among other startling and, he said, unexpected differences that emerged was that his average male client recommends him to 2.6 others. His average female client recommends him to 21 others. 2.6 versus 21. Wow. Read, study. Marketing to Women, How to Increase Your Share of the World's Largest Market, by Marty Barletta. The Power of the Purse, How Smart Businesses Are Adapting to the World's Most Important Consumers, Women, by Farrah Warner. Why She Buys, The New Strategy for Reaching the World's Most Powerful Consumers, by Bridget Brennan. Keyword, world. This applies literally everywhere. What Women Want, The Global Market Turns Female Friendly, by Paco Underhill. The Soccer Mom Myth, Today's Female Consumer, Who She Really Is, Why She Really Buys, by Michelle Miller and Holly Buchanan. Influence, How Women's Soaring Economic Power Will Transform Our World for the Better, by Maddie Dykewald. The Female Brain, by Luann Brizendine, M.D. 12.6.4 Can you pass the squint test? One indicator of readiness to embrace this colossal women's market opportunity comes from conducting what I call a squint test. 1. Look at a photograph of your exec team. 2. Squint. 3. Does the composition of the team more or less look like the composition of the market you aim to serve? For example, if women buy 70% of your goods and services, consumer and or commercial, does the squint reveal a heavily female-laden top team? This is not in any way, shape, or form about quotas. It is about good sense in the capitalistic pursuit of profit maximization. 12.6.5. Opportunity knocks, but it's not all that easy to open the door. This section is not about quote-unquote selling to women. It is about understanding the enormity of the women's market opportunity and responding to that opportunity. Responding effectively, in fact, translates into no less than a stem-to-stern strategic reorientation of the enterprise. Marketing and selling is the tail of the dog, and it does not wag the dog. Far more important than selling and marketing are the attributes of the product or service itself. For example, according to the advisory services firm CEO quoted above, the concerns women have about their financial future are different in kind, not different in degree, he said. The men were more inclined to want to play the market as if it were a game. The women, he said, were invariably more interested in long-term personal and family security. Investing was anything but a game to them. Therefore, his basic financial management product portfolio needed to be very different to cater to women's goals. Bottom line, the company that wishes to take full advantage of the opportunity outlined in this section must begin its journey with a stem-to-stern examination of every nook and every cranny of the organization. A how not to guide. Taking advantage of this enormous underserved market is not about a 2018 women's initiative or a marketing to women campaign. It is, if you're serious, about wholesale enterprise realignment, period. 12.6.6, market power, coming, dollars and cents, attractions. $22 trillion in assets will shift to women by 2020. Source, The Street and Investment News. Full title of the article, $22 trillion in assets will shift to women by 2020, why men need to watch out. Principal causes for the staggering wealth transfer, 1, enormous aging family population, boomers plus, in which men die first, 2, women's significant advances in the workplace. Underserved markets, 2. 12.7. The aging oldies market narrative. The enormous aging market. Oldies are beautiful, with lots of years to go and all the money. Women's purchasing power at home and worldwide is stupendous, and while most would acknowledge that, all too few take the plunge and launch the wholesale enterprise renovation needed to fully exploit this, yes, stupendous opportunity. There is a second wildly underserved market. It too is stupendous in size. In this case, however, most firms seem clueless, or worse, even seem to turn their back on the opportunity. 12.7.1. Every 8 seconds. AARP, referring to what it calls the silver tsunami, offered overpowering statistics. 1. U.S. population over 50, 109 million. Next 10 years, age 50 plus will increase by 19 million. Ages 18 to 49 will increase by just 6 million. 2. Percent of total spending by the over 50s, 50%. Percent of marketing budgets aimed at the over 50s, 10%. 3. U.S. One boomer, born between 1946 and 1964, one boomer will turn age 65 every 8 seconds through 2029. 12.7.2. The new customer majority. David Wolf and Robert Snyder, in their book Ageless Marketing, translate the information above into a concise statement about the aging market. Age 44 to 65, they say, is the new customer majority. Ken Dykewald, the rare marketing guru who pays attention to the aging market opportunity, says in Age Power, How the 21st Century Will Be Ruled by the New Old, age power will rule the 21st century, and we are woefully unprepared. We are in general unprepared, with fundamental repercussions in many areas, for example, healthcare in particular. When it comes to business, though, I'd say we are unprepared and have, for reasons unclear, paid virtually no attention to that 44 to 65 age group that Wolf and Snyder discuss. 12.7.3. 50 at 50. On rare occasions, one comes across a remark, a single sentence, that completely reframes your worldview. What Bill Novelli, former AARP chief, says below, from his book, 50 Plus, Igniting a Revolution to Reinvent America, was for me one of those times. People turning 50 today have more than half of their adult life ahead of them. 50 years of age, only half done. Businesses, are you listening? Half done at 50, 7 out of 13. From Marty Barletta in Prime Time Women. Average number of cars purchased per U.S. household in their lifetime, 13. Average number of cars bought per household after the head of household is age 50 or above, 7. Anybody in Detroit listening? Not as far as I can determine. Related, 55 to 64 versus 25 to 34. More from Primetime Women. New cars and trucks, 20% more spending by 55 to 64s than 25 to 34s. Meals at full-service restaurants, plus 29%, airfare, plus 38%, sports equipment, plus 58%, motorized recreational vehicles, plus 103%, wine, plus 113%, maintenance, repairs, and home insurance, plus 127%, vacation homes, plus 258%, housekeeping and yard services, plus 250%. Honestly, do I need to comment on this? 12.7.4. Aging market, wealth, 47x. From Pew Research. In 2009, households headed by adults ages 65 and older had 47 times as much net wealth as the typical household headed by someone under 35 years of age. In 1984, this had been a less lopsided 10-to-1 ratio. 12.7.5. Aging market. Not the best opportunity, try only opportunity. The new customer majority is the only adult market with realistic prospects for significant sales growth in dozens of product lines for thousands of companies. David Wolf and Robert Snyder, Ageless Marketing. 12.7.6. They just don't get it. Marketers' attempts to reach those over 50 have been miserably unsuccessful. No market's motivations and needs are so poorly understood. Peter Francesi, founding publisher, American Demographics. Marty Barletta in Prime Time Women. One particularly puzzling category of youth obsession is the highly coveted target of men age 18 to 34, and it's always referred to as the highly coveted category. Marketers have been distracted by men aged 18 to 34 because they're getting harder to reach. So what? Who wants to reach them? Beyond fast food and beer, they don't buy much of anything. The theory is that if you get them while they're young, they're yours for life. What nonsense. 54 years of age has been the highest cutoff point for any marketing initiative I've been involved in, which is pretty weird when you can